hit my mouth, I lock my lips and close my eyes and hold my breath. More water comes in, first a trickle, then heavier. I feel it start going up my nostrils. I tighten up, keeping my mouth closed. More water cascades in. I try to move my head, try to tilt my head up or find some way of escaping the onslaught, but I can't move. The water completely fills my nose. I'm starting to panic. I can't hold my breath much longer, and I need to get the water out of my nose and away from my mouth. Only one way. Blow it out. But the towel is there. Still, I try to exhale now, to push the water out, and for a second, maybe two, that works. I try to keep exhaling, try to empty my lungs so as to keep the water at bay. But there's too much water flowing down, and now the big problem. A man can exhale for only so long. And when you're spent, when the exhale is over, and this is the awful part, you eventually have to inhale. That is where I'm at now. When my exhale comes to an end, water starts pouring back in, filling up my nostrils and mouth. I can't help myself. I'm running out of air, and that agony overcomes all else. Holding my exhale is killing me, and yet I know what awaits. I have to inhale, I have to breathe in, but there is no air, only water. Lots of water. The inhale opens the floodgate. The water flows freely down my nose into my mouth. No way to stop it. My inhalation drags water through my mouth and down my windpipe. No air. My body goes into spasm. I start to buck, try to kick out, try to flail my head, but I'm strapped down. There is no escape from the water. There's no relief or let up at all. It just keeps getting worse. You don't just want it to stop. You don't just need it to stop. It has to stop. It's like I'm being held underwater, but it's worse. I can't move. I'm locked in concrete. I'm drowning, Leo. Drowning and suffocating. All rational thought is gone. I can feel a little part of my sanity start to give way. A permanent rip in my psyche, something from which I know I'll never recover. Every cell in my body is begging for oxygen, for just one breath. But there is none. I'm gasping and taking in more water. I want to stop, but my gag reflex is unconsciously forcing me to exhale and inhale. The water floods my throat and trachea. Please, God, let me breathe. I'm dying. I know that now. A primitive part of me has given up, surrendered, wishing death would speed along and get it over with. But it won't. I flail, I convulse, I suffer, I hallucinate. I hallucinate a voice yelling to stop, to get away from him. If every part of me wasn't starving for air, if every fiber of my being was concentrating on my need to escape this, I might say the voice was female. I could actually feel my eyes start to roll back in my head as I hear the blast from somewhere deep inside my brain. And then I see a light. I'm dying, Leo. Dying and hallucinating. And the last thing I see is the most beautiful face imaginable. Morris. Chapter 27. I'm unstrapped and rolled to my side. I suck in air, paralyzed to do anything more than that for a while. I gasp and try not to swallow. Water pours out of my mouth and nostrils, pooling on the floor and diluting the crimson blood oozing out of Andy Reeves' head. I don't care about any of that. I just care about air. It doesn't take all that long for my strength to start returning. I look up to see who saved me. But maybe I am dead. My brain was starved of oxygen too long. Maybe I'm still being waterboarded and this is some weird state I've reached because of the hallucination. No, mirage. Still there. It's Mora. We have to get out of here, she says. I still can't believe what I'm seeing. Mora, I... Not now, Nap. Something about her using my name. I'm trying to put it together, figure the next move, but all that stay-where-you-are logic has flown out the window. Can you walk? I nod. By the time we hit the second step, I'm back in the moment. One thing at a time, I tell myself. Get out of here. We reach the ground floor and I realize we are in a dilapidated warehouse of some kind. I'm surprised by the silence, but it's probably... What time is it? I met up with Reeves at midnight, so it has to be deep into the night or early morning. This way, Mora says. We head outside into the night sky. I notice that my breathing is a little funny, faster than normal, as though I'm still fearful the ability to do so might be taken away from me again. I spot his yellow Mustang in the corner, but Mora, I still can't believe it's Mora, is leading me toward another car. She hits the remote in her left hand. In her right, I see the gun. I get in the passenger side, she the driver's. She starts up and tears in reverse. 2 minutes later, we are heading north on the Garden State Parkway. I stare at her profile, and I don't think I've ever seen anything that beautiful. Mora, it can wait, Nap. Who killed my brother? I see a tear run down that beautiful cheek. I think, Mora says, maybe I did.
Chapter 28. We are back in Westbridge. Mora parks the car at the Benjamin Franklin Middle School lot. I need you to give me your phone, she says to me. I'm surprised to find it's still in my pocket. I use my fingerprint to unlock it and hand it to her. Her thumbs dance across the screen. What are you doing?
You're a cop, she says.
You know that these phones can be traced, right?
Yes.
I'm loading on a sort of VPN anti-tracker so it looks like you're in another state. I didn't know that kind of technology existed, but I'm not surprised. Her thumbs finish the dance. Then she hands me back the phone, opens the car door, gets out. I do the same.
What are we doing here, Mora?
I want to see it again.
See what? But she starts toward the path and I follow. I try not to stare as she moves, her walk still panther-like, but I can't help it. As we head up into the darkness, she turns around and says, God, how I've missed you. And then turns back around and keeps walking. Just like that. I don't react. I can't react. But every part of me feels ripped open. I hurry to catch up to her. The full moon tonight gives off enough light. The shadows cut across our faces as we start up the familiar route. We stay silent, both because the darkness calls for that and because, well, these woods used to be our place. You would think tonight of all nights that would haunt me. You would think that tonight of all nights, walking with Mora, the ghosts would be surrounding me, tapping me on the shoulder, mocking me from behind the rocks and trees. But they are not. Tonight I'm not falling back. I don't hear the whispers. The ghosts, oddly enough, stay hidden. You know about the videotape, Mora says, part question, mostly statement. How long have you been following me, I ask.
2 days.
I know about the tape, I say. Did you know?
I was on it, Nap.
No, I mean... Did you know Hank had it, or that he gave it to David Rainiff for safekeeping? She shakes her head. Up ahead, the old fence comes into view. Mora veers off the path to the right. She bounces a few steps down the hill and stops herself by a tree. I make my way there. We are getting closer to the old base. She stops and stares at the old fence. I stop and stare at her face.
I waited here that night. Behind this tree.
She looks down at the ground.
I sat right here and watched the fence. I had a joint from your brother, and I had my flask from you.
She meets my eyes, and maybe it's not the ghosts, but something smacks me hard in the heart.
You remember that flask?
I'd gotten it at a garage sale at the old Siegel house. It was old and dented. The color was gunmetal. The faded engraving read,
A ma vie de cœur entier, which was a 15th century French saying, you have my whole heart for my whole life. I remember asking Mr. Siegel where he'd gotten it, but he couldn't remember. He called over Mrs. Siegel and asked her, but neither of them could even remember owning it. It felt somehow magical and stupid, like a genie's lamp I was supposed to find. And so I bought it for $3, and I gave it to Maura, who giddily said, a gift that involves romance and alcohol? Am I not the perfect boyfriend? You are, she'd said. And then she threw her arms around me and kissed me hard. I remember, I say now. Then, so you sat by this tree with a joint and a flask. Who else was with you?
I was alone.
What about the conspiracy club?
You knew about that?
I gave a half shrug. Moore looks back toward the base.
We weren't supposed to meet that night. I think seeing that copter making that tape, it freaked some of them out. It was all a game before then. That night made it real.
Anyway, I wasn't really part of the, finger quotes, club. My only real friend was Leo. He had plans with Diana that night, so I came here and sat against this tree. I had my joint and my Jack in the flask. Maura slides now to the ground and sits just as, I assume, she sat that night.
A small smile is on her face. I was thinking about you. I wished I was at your game. I hated the whole jock thing before you, but I loved to watch you skate.
I don't know what to say to that, so I stay still.
Anyway, I could only get to the home games, and you guys were playing away that night. Summit, I think.
Parsippany Hills. She chuckles. Figures you'd remember. Anyway,
it didn't matter. We'd be together in a few hours.
I was just getting a little ahead of you here in the woods. The kids call it pre-gaming now, so
I kept drinking, and I remember feeling a little sad.
Why sad?
She shakes her head. It doesn't matter. I want to know. It'd be over soon.
What?
From her spot on the ground, she looks up. You and me.
Wait. You knew all that when you were just sitting here?
Maura shakes her head. You can still be so obtuse, Nap. I had no idea what was about to happen.
Then?
What I mean is, I knew you and I would never make it, not for the long haul. We'd finish senior year, maybe last the summer. I loved you.
I just blurted out like that. It startles her for a second, but not much longer than that.
And I loved you, Nap. But you were off to a fancy college and a big life, and there wouldn't be room for me, and God, what a cliche, right? Maura stops, closes her eyes, shakes it off. There's no reason to revisit this right now.
She's right. I help her ease back on topic. So, you were sitting here drinking and smoking.
Right. And I'm getting a little wasted. Not terribly, just tipsy. And I'm staring at this base. It's always so quiet there, but suddenly I hear a noise.
What kind of noise?
I don't know. Men shouting and engines starting up. So I stand up.
Maura does that now, sliding her back up the tree.
And I figure, what the hell? Let's get to the bottom of this once and for all. Be a hero to the whole conspiracy club cause. So I start marching toward the fence.
Maura marches toward the base. I stay right with her. What did you see? I ask.
There were a bunch more of those warning signs, like a ton, circling the base.
They were all bright red, remember?
Yes. Like, this is your last chance, go back or die. We were always afraid to go past them because they were too close to the fence line, but that night, I didn't even slow down. I actually started sprinting.
We were both back there now, on that night, and I almost hesitated the spot where those red signs used to be. We cross the invisible barrier, heading straight toward the rusted fence. She points to the top of the corner pole.
There was a camera up there. I remember thinking that they might see me, but I was flying high, not a care in the world. I just kept running. And then she slows, stops. Her hand comes up to her throat.
Mora, I was right about here when the lights came on.
Lights? Spotlights.
Huge ones with big beams. They were so bright I had to put my hand up to shade my eyes.
She does that now, shading her eyes from an imaginary light.
I couldn't make out a thing. I was sort of frozen there in the beam, not sure what to do. And then I heard the gunfire.
Moore lowers her hand. They were shooting at you.
Yeah, I guess.
What do you mean, you guess?
I mean, that's what started it, right?
Moore's voice goes up an octave now. I can hear the fear, the regret.
Me? I ran toward the fence like a stupid kid. I ignored the warning signs. I tripped a wire or they spotted me or something, so they did what they promised on the signs. They started shooting. So, yeah, I guess they were shooting at me.
What did you do?
I turned and ran. I remember hearing a bullet hit a tree right by my head, but see, eventually, I made it out alive. The bullets, they never hit me.
She raises her head and looks me straight in the eyes. Leo, I say.
I kept running, and they kept shooting, and then...
Then what?
I heard a woman scream. I'm sprinting as fast as I can, dodging trees, trying to keep low so I make a smaller target. But I turn when I hear the scream, a woman's scream. I see someone, maybe a man, in silhouette through those bright lights. More gunfire blasts. Then I hear the woman scream again, except this time I think I recognize the voice. She screams, Leo! She screams, Leo, help! Except the help is cut off by another shot being fired.
I realize I'm holding my breath.
And now I hear a man yell for everyone to hold their fire. Silence. Dead silence. And then maybe, I don't know anymore, but maybe someone yells, what have you done? And then someone else yells, there was another girl, we have to find her. But I don't hear that for sure. I don't know if it's in my head or for real, because I'm running. I'm running and I'm not stopping.
She looks at me like she needs my help, and like I better not offer any. I don't move. I don't think I can. They just shot them?
Moore doesn't reply.
Then I say something dumb.
And you just ran away? What? I mean, I get why you ran then, to get away from the danger, but when you were safe, why didn't you call the police? And say what?
How about, hello, I saw two people shot?
Her eyes flick away from me. Maybe I should have, she says.
That's not really a good enough answer.
I was stoned and scared and I freaked out, okay? It's not like I knew they'd been shot dead or something. I didn't see or hear Leo, just Diana. I panicked. You get that, right? So I hid for a while.
Where?
You remember that stone hut behind the town pool?
I nod.
I just sat there in the dark. I don't know how long. You can see Hobart Avenue from there. I saw big black cars driving by slowly. Maybe I was just paranoid, but I thought they were looking for me. At some point, I decided to go to your house.
This is news to me, but then again, what about tonight isn't?
You went to my house? That was my destination, yeah. But when I reached your street, I saw another big black car parked on the corner. It's past midnight. Two men are sitting in suits watching your house, so I knew. They were covering their bases.
She came closer to me.
Pretend now that I call this into the police. I call and I say, I think the guys at the base maybe shot someone. I don't really have any details or anything, but I have to give my name. They'd ask what I was doing near the base. I could lie, or I could say I was up there smoking a joint and drinking some Jack. By the time they'd listen to me, those guys at the base, they'd clean it up. You really not see this?
So you just ran again, I say.
Yes.
To Ellie's.
She nods. At one point I said to myself, let's give it a day or two, see what happens. Maybe they'll forget about me, but of course, they don't. I'm watching from behind a rock when they interrogate my mother. And then when I see on the news that they found Leo's and Diana's bodies, I mean, I knew. The news didn't say anything about them being shot. They said they were hit by a train on the other side of town. So now what? What could I do? The evidence was gone. Who would ever believe me?
I would have, I say.
Why didn't you come to me?
Oh, Nap, are you serious? You could have told me, Maura.
And what would you have done? You, a hot-headed 18-year-old boy.
She glares at me for a moment.
If I'd told you, you'd be dead too.
We stand there and let that truth hang in the air.
Come on,
Maura says with a shiver. Let's get out of here. Chapter 29. When we get back to the car, I say, I left my car at that club.
I called it in, Maura says.
What does that mean?
I called the club and gave them the make and license plate and said that I was too drunk to drive. I told them I'd pick it up tomorrow.
She had thought of everything.
You can't go home, Nap.
I hadn't planned on that anyway. She starts up the car. So where are we going? I ask.
I have a safe place, she says.
So since that night, I don't even know how to put it. You've been on the run?
Yes.
So why now, Maura? Why after 15 years is someone killing the rest of the conspiracy club?
I don't know. But you were with Rex when he was shot?
She nods.
I started relaxing the last 3-4 years. I figured, I mean, why go after me anymore? There was zero evidence. The base was long closed. No one would believe a word I said. I was low on funds and trying to find a safe way to see what was happening. Anyway, I took a risk, but it was like Rex wanted to keep the past closed as much as I did. He needed help in his side business, setting up men for drunk driving.
He had nicer labels for it, but yes.
We turn off Eisenhower Parkway, right near Jim Johnston's steakhouse.
I saw some CCTV footage from the night Rex was murdered, I say.
The guy was a stone-cold pro.
And yet, I say, you escaped.
Maybe.
Meaning?
When I saw Rex go down, I figured, they found us. I'm dead. You know. I was there that night. I was the real target, I thought. But maybe they knew about the whole conspiracy club. It made sense. So as soon as Rex was shot, I moved fast. But the guy was already turning the gun on me. I jumped into the driver's seat, started the car, drove like a bat out of hell. But like I said, he was a pro.
Maura shrugs.
So how come he didn't kill me, too?
You think he let you go?
She doesn't know.
We park in the back of a dumpy no-tell in East Orange. She isn't staying there. It's an old trick, she explains. She parks at the no-tell, so if the police or whoever spot the car or start a search based on the car, she's not there. She's renting a room about a quarter mile down the road. The car is stolen, she explains. If she senses any danger, she'll just abandon it and steal another.
Right now, I'm changing locations every 2 days.
We get to her rented room and sit on the bed.
I want to tell you the rest, Maura says.
As she does,
I stare at her. There's no sense of déjà vu. I'm not the teenager who made love with her in the woods. I try not to get lost in her eyes, but in her eyes, it's all there. The history, the what-ifs, the sliding doors. In her eyes, I see you, Leo. I see the life I once knew and have always missed.
Maura tells me about where she's been since the night you died. It is hard to hear what her life has been like, but I listen without interrupting. I don't know what I'm feeling anymore. It's like I'm one exposed nerve ending. It's 3 a.m. when she finishes.
We need some rest, she says.
I nod. She heads into the bathroom and takes a shower. She comes out in a terrycloth robe with her hair wrapped in a towel. The moonlight hits her in just the right way, and I don't think I've ever seen a more magnificent sight.
I head into the bathroom, strip down, shower. When I come out, I have a towel wrapped around my waist. The lights are out, except for a low-wattage lamp on the night table. Mora stands there. The towel is gone from her wet hair. She still wears the bathrobe. She looks at me. No pretense anymore. I cross the room fast. We both know it. Neither says it. I take her in my arms and kiss her hard. She kisses me back, her tongue snaking into my mouth. She pulls the towel off me. I yank open her robe. This is like nothing I have ever experienced before. It is a hunger, a tearing, a ripping, a healing. It is rough and loving, it is gentle, it is harsh, it is a dance, it is an attack. It is ravenous and intense and ferocious and almost unbearably tender. When it's over, we collapse on the bed, staggered, shattered, like we'll never be exactly the same, and maybe we won't. Eventually she moves so as to lay her head on my chest, her hand on my stomach. We don't speak. We stare at the ceiling until our eyes close. My last thought before I pass out is a primitive one. Don't leave me. Don't leave me ever again. Chapter 30. We make love again at dawn. Mora rolls on top of me. Our eyes meet and stay locked. It's slower, this time more soulful, comfortable, vulnerable. Later, when we are lying back and staring up into the silence, my mobile dings a text. It's from Muse, and it's short. Don't forget. 9 a.m. sharp. I show it to Mora. My boss. Could be a setup. I shake my head. Muse told me about it before I met up with Reeves. I'm still on my back. Mora flips around so that her chin is on my chest. Do you think they found Andy Reeves yet? It is something I've been wondering, too. I know how that will play out. Someone notices the yellow car first. Maybe they call the cops right then and there. Maybe they search the premises. Whatever. They find the body. Did Reeves have ID on him? Probably. If not, they'll figure out his name from the car's license plate. They'll get his schedule. They'll see he worked that night at the Hunka Hunka. A club like that will have CCTV cameras in the lot. I'll be on them. So will my car. The CCTV will show me getting into Reeves' yellow Ford Mustang with the victim. I'll be the last person to see him alive. We can drive by the scene on the way, I say. See if the cops are there yet. Mora rolls off me and stands. I'm about to do the same, but I can't help pausing in something approaching sheer awe to admire her first. So why did your boss call this meeting? I'd rather not speculate, I say, but I don't think it's good.
Then don't go, she says.
What do you suggest I do?
Run away with me instead.
That could be the greatest suggestion ever made by anyone ever, but I'm not running. Not now, anyway. I shake my head. We need to see this through. Her reply is to get dressed. I do the same. We head outside. Mora leads the way back to the parking lot of the No-Tell Motel. We scout the area, see no nearby surveillance, and decide to risk it. We get in the same car we used last night and start toward Route 280. You remember how to get there? I ask. Mora nods.
The warehouse was in Irvington, not far from that graveyard off the parkway.
She takes 280 to the Garden State Parkway and veers off at the next exit for South Orange Avenue. We pass by an aging strip mall and turn into an industrial area that, like many such areas in New Jersey, has seen better days. Industry leaves, manufacturing plants close. That's just the way it is. Most times, progress comes in and builds something new, but sometimes, like here, the warehouses and factories are simply left to decay and disintegrate into bitter ruins that hint at past glory. There are no people around, no cars, no activity at all. It looks like the set from some dystopian movie after the bombs hit. We cruise past the yellow Mustang without so much as slowing down. No one has been here yet. We are safe.
for now.
Morris swings the car back onto the parkway. Where's your meeting?
Newark, I tell her. But I better shower and change first. She gives me a crooked smile. I think you look great.
I look satiated, I say. There's a difference.
Fair enough.
The meeting will be serious. I point at my face, so I need to figure a way to wipe this grin from my face.
Go ahead and try.
We both smile like two love-struck dopes.
She puts her hand on mine and keeps it there. So where to, she asks.
The hunka-hunka, I say. I'll grab my car and take it home.
Okay.
We enjoy the quiet for a few moments. Then in a soft voice, Maura says,
I can't tell you how many times I picked up the phone to call you.
So why didn't you?
Where would it have led, Nap?
1 year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, if I'd called you and told you the truth, where would you be right now?
I don't know.
Me neither. So I'd sit there with the phone in my hand and I'd play it all out again. If I told you, what would you do? Where would you be?
I wanted to keep you safe.
And if I came home and told the truth, who'd believe me? No one. If someone did, if the police took me seriously, then those guys at the base would have to silence me, right? And then I started thinking about it this way. I was alone in the woods that night. I ran away and hid for years. So maybe the guys at the base would pin Leo and Diana on me. How hard would that be to do?
I study her profile. And I say, what aren't you telling me?
She puts on the turn signal with a little too much care, puts her hand back on the wheel, keeps her eyes too focused on the road.
It's a little hard to explain.
Try.
I was on the road for a long time, moving, hiding, being on edge, pretty much my entire adult life. That's the only life I knew. That constant rush, I was so used to it, to running and hiding. I didn't get being relaxed. It wasn't my baseline. In my own way, I'd been okay like that, under threat, trying to survive, but then, when I slowed down, and I could see clearly.
What?
She shrugs. It was empty. I had nothing. No one. It felt like maybe that was my fate, you know? I was okay if I kept moving. It hurt more when I thought about what could have been.
Her grip on the wheel tightens.
How about you, Nap?
How about me what?
How's your life been?
I want to say it would have been better if you stayed, but I don't. Instead, I tell her to drop me off 2 blocks away so I can walk to the club without anyone seeing her on CCTV. Sure, there's a chance we'll be picked up by another camera in the area, but by then, this will all be played out, whatever way it ends up going.
Before I get out of the car, Maura again shows me the new app I should use to contact her.
It's supposedly untraceable, and the messages are permanently deleted 5 minutes after they arrive. When she's done, she hands me the phone. I reach for the door handle. I'm about to ask her to make me a promise that she won't run, that no matter what happens, she won't just disappear on me again. That's not me. I kiss her instead. It's a gentle kiss that lingers.
There are so many things I'm feeling, she says.
Me too.
And I want to feel them all. I don't want to be guarded with you.
We both get this connection and openness, don't we? Neither one of us is a kid anymore, and I understand how this potent cocktail of lust and want and danger and nostalgia can warp your perspective. But that's not what is happening to us.
I know it. She knows.
I'm glad you're back, I say, which may rank as the biggest understatement of my life. Moore kisses me again, harder this time so that I feel it everywhere. Then she pushes me away, like that old song about the honesty being too much.
I'll wait for you by that office in Newark, she says.
I get out of the car. Moore drives off. My car is where I left it. Hunka Hunka is, of course, closed. There are 2 other cars in the lot, and I wonder whether they too were claimed to be the result of too much drinking. I need to fill in Augie about Moore's return and Reeve's demise.
As I drive home, I call him on my mobile. When Augie answers, I say, Muse wants to meet me at 9 a.m.
What about? Augie asks.
She wouldn't say. But there are some things I need to tell you first.
I'm listening.
Can you meet me at Mike's at 8:45? Mike's is a coffee shop not far from the county prosecutor's office.
I'll be there.
Augie hangs up as I pull into my driveway and park. I manage to stumble out of my car when I hear a laugh. I turn and see my neighbor, Tammy Walsh.
Look what the cat dragged in, she says.
I wave to her. Hey, Tammy.
Long night?
Just some work. But Tammy smiles as if it's written all over my face.
Yeah, okay, Nap.
I can't help but smile, too. Not buying that?
Not in the least, she says. But good for you.
Thanks. Some 24 hours, am I right? I shower and try to get my head back in the game. I pretty much have the truth now, don't I? But I'm still missing something, Leo.
What?
Or am I overthinking it? The base was hiding a terrible secret that it was a black site for high-value potential terrorists. Would the government kill to keep that a secret? The answer is so obvious, the question is by definition rhetorical. Of course they would. So that night, something set them off. Maybe it was Mora running toward the fence. Maybe they spotted you and Diana first. Either way, they panicked. Shots were fired. You and Diana were killed. So what could Reeves and his cohorts do? They couldn't just call the cops and admit what happened. No way. That would expose the entire illegal operation. They also couldn't just make you both disappear. That would lead to too many questions. The cops, and especially Augie, wouldn't rest. No, they needed a good old-fashioned cover-up. Everyone knew the legend of those train tracks. I obviously don't know all the details, but my guess is they pulled the bullets from your bodies and then transported you to the tracks. The impact of the train would leave the corpses in a state where no medical examiner would find any clues. That makes total sense. I have all my answers now, don't I? Except 15 years later, Rex and Hank are murdered. How does that fit in? Only two members of the conspiracy club are left alive now. Beth, who is hiding, and Mora. So what does that mean? Don't know, but maybe Augie will have a thought. Mike's coffee shop and pizzeria somehow manages to look like neither a coffee shop nor a pizzeria. It's in the heart of Newark, on the corner of Broad and William, with a big red awning. Augie sits by the window. He's staring at a guy who is eating pizza before 9 in the morning. The slice is so obscenely enormous it makes his full-size paper plate look like a cocktail napkin. Augie is about to crack wise about that when he sees my face and stops.
What happened?
There's no reason to sugarcoat any of this. Leo and Diana weren't killed by a train, I say. They were shot. To his credit, Augie doesn't start with the what?
How can you say that? There were no bullets found, standard-issue denials.
He knows I wouldn't just say something like that.
Tell me.
I do just that. I tell him about Andy Reeves first. I can see he wants to stop me, wants to argue that none of this means Reeves or his men killed Diana and Leo, that he was waterboarding me because he still wanted to protect the secrecy around that black site. But he doesn't interrupt. Again, he knows me well enough. Then I get to Mora rescuing me. I skip how Reeves dies for now. I trust Augie with my life, but there is no reason to put him in a spot where he may have to testify to what I'm saying here. Simply put, if I don't say Mora shot Reeves, then Augie can't testify to that if he's under oath. I keep going. I can see my words are landing on my old mentor like body blows. I want to pause, give him time to breathe and recover, but I know that it will only make it worse, and that it would not be what he wants. So I just keep the onslaught going. I tell Augie about the scream Mora heard. I tell Augie about the gunfire and then the silence. Augie sits back when I'm done. He looks out the window and blinks twice.
So now we know, he says.
I don't say anything. We both sit there. Now that we know the truth, we are waiting for something to feel different.
But that guy is still eating his enormous slice of pizza. Cars are still cruising down Broad Street. People are still going to work. Nothing has changed. You and Diana are both still dead.
Is it over?
Augie asks. Is what over? He spreads his arm wide as if to indicate everything.
It doesn't feel over, I say.
Meaning?
There has to be justice for Leo and Diana.
I thought you said he was dead.
He.
Augie doesn't use Andy Reeves' name. Just in case. There were other people at that base that night.
And you want to catch them all,
don't you? Augie turns away. Someone pulled the trigger, I say. Probably not Reeves. Someone picked them up and put them in, I don't know, a car or a truck. Someone pulled the bullets out of their bodies. Someone tossed your daughter's body onto a railroad track and... Augie's wincing, his eyes closed. You were indeed a great mentor, Augie. Which is why I can't move on. You were the one who railed against injustice. You, more than anyone I ever knew, insisted on making sure the bad guys paid a price for what they did. You taught me that if we don't get justice, if no one is punished, we never have balance.
You punished Andy Reeves, he says.
That's not enough. I lean forward now. I had seen Augie knock heads too many times to count. He was the one who helped me take care of my first Trey, a subhuman slither of scrotum, whom I had arrested for sexually assaulting a 6-year-old girl, his girlfriend's daughter. It got kicked on a technicality, and he was heading back home, back to that little girl. So, Augie and I, we stopped him. What aren't you telling me, Augie? He drops his head into both hands. Augie! He rubs his face. When he faces me again, his eyes are red.
You said Maura blames herself for running toward that fence.
In part, yes.
She even said maybe it was her fault.
But it's not.
But she feels that way, right? Because maybe if she didn't get stoned and run like that... That's what she said, right?
What's your point, I ask?
Do you want to punish Maura?
I meet his eyes. What the hell is going on, Augie?
Do you?
Of course not.
Even though she might in part be responsible?
She isn't. He leans back.
Maura told you about the big, bright lights, all that noise. Made you wonder why no one called it in, right?
Right.
I mean, you know that area. The Myers live close by that base, on that cul-de-sac. So did the Carlinos and the Branhams.
Wait, I see it now.
You guys got a call?
He looks off.
Dodie Meyer. She said there was something going on at the base. She told us about the lights. She thought maybe some kids broke in and turned on the floodlights and set off firecrackers.
I feel a small stone form in my chest. So what did you do, Augie?
I was in my office. The dispatcher asked me if I wanted to take the call. It was late. The other patrol car was handling a domestic disturbance, so I said yes.
What happened?
The lights were out by the time I got there. I noticed a pickup truck by the gate. It was ready to pull out.
There was a tarp over the back.
I rang the bell at the fence. Andy Reeves came out. It was late at night, but I didn't question why so many people were still at a Department of Agriculture compound. What you said about a black site, that doesn't surprise me. I didn't know exactly what was going on, but I still foolishly trusted my government back then to be doing the right thing. So Andy Reeves comes to the gate. I tell him about us getting a disturbance call.
What does he say?
That a deer jumped into the fence. That's what set off the alarms and lights. He said one of his guards panicked and started shooting. That was the gunfire. He said the guard killed the deer. He pointed to that tarp in the back of the pickup.
Did you buy that?
I don't know.
Not really.
But the place was classified government stuff, so I let it go.
What did you do next? His voice is coming from a million miles away now.
I went home.
My shift was over, I got into bed, and a few hours later...
He shrugs away the rest of the thought, but I'm not ready to let it go.
You got the call about Diana and Leo.
Augie nods. His eyes are wet now.
And you didn't see a connection?
He thinks about that.
Maybe I didn't want to see one. That way, like I asked you with Maura, it wasn't my fault. Maybe I was just trying to justify my own mistake, but I never saw much of a link.
My phone goes off. I see the time is 9:10 a.m. even before I read Muse's text, "Where the F are you?" I text back, "There in a minute." I rise. His eyes are on the floor.
"You're late for your meeting," he says without looking up. "Go."
I hesitate. In a way, all this explains so much. Augie's reticence over the years, his insistence that it was just two stoned kids doing something stupid, his disconnect. His mind wouldn't let him link the murder of his own daughter to his visit that night, to the base, because then he'd have to live with the additional guilt of maybe not doing anything about it. As I turn and head for the exit, I wonder about that now. I wonder about dropping this all on him, shattering him anew. Whether every night from now on, as he closes his eyes, he's going to see that tarp over the back of a pickup truck and wonder what was underneath it. Or has he already been doing that in some subconscious way? Is the reason he so easily accepted the more obvious explanation for his daughter's death because he couldn't face his own small role in what happened? My phone rings. It's Muse. "I'm almost there," I tell her.
"What the hell have you done?"
"Why? What's up?"
"Just hurry up."
Chapter 31. The Essex County Prosecutor's Office is located on Market Street in the simply dubbed Veterans Courthouse. I work here, so I know the building well. The place is always humming. More than a third of the entire state's criminal cases are tried here. As I head inside, I hear an unfamiliar ding coming from my phone, and I realize it's that new app Maura installed. I read the message from her. "Drove by again. Cops found yellow Mustang." This isn't good, of course, but it would still be a while before the course of events I laid out earlier would lead them to me. I have time. Probably. I type back, "Okay. Heading into meeting now." Lauren Muse is waiting for me at the door, staring daggers. She's a short woman, and she is flanked on both sides by tall men in suits. The younger of the two is thin and wiry, with hard eyes. The older guy sports a halo of too long hair circling his bald dome. His protruding gut is giving his shirt buttons a hell of a battle. When we step into the outer office, the older guy says, "I'm Special Agent Rockdale. This is Special Agent Krueger." "FBI." We shake hands. Krueger, of course, tries to give me the dominant squeeze. I frown at him. With that done, Rockdale turns to Muse and says, "Thank you for your cooperation, ma'am. We'd be grateful if you could leave us now." Muse doesn't like that.
"Leave?"
"Yes, ma'am.
This is my office.
And the Bureau appreciates your cooperation in this matter, but we really need to speak to Detective Dumas alone."
"No,"
I say. They turn to me. "Pardon?"
"I would like Prosecutor Muse to attend any questioning."
"You're not suspected of any crime," he says.
"I still want her here."
Rockdale turns back to Muse. Muse says,
"You heard the man."
"Ma'am."
"Stop calling me ma'am."
"Prosecutor Muse, my apologies. You received a call from your superior, did you not?"
Through gritted teeth, Muse replies, "I did, yes."
Her superior, I know, is the governor of the state of New Jersey. "And he did ask that you cooperate and give us jurisdiction on this matter of great national security, did he not?"
My phone vibrates. I sneak a quick peek, and I'm surprised to see it's from Tammy. "Van of guys searching your house, wearing FBI windbreakers."
I'm not surprised. They're looking for the original tape. They won't find it in my house. I buried it where else? In the woods, near the old base.
"The governor did contact me," Muse continues.
but Detective Dumas has now requested counsel.
Irrelevant.
Sorry?
This is a matter of national security. What we are about to discuss is highly classified.
Muse looks at me. Nap? I think about it. I think about the issues Augie had raised, about what we should keep secret, about who is to blame for what happened to Leo, and how I can get to the bottom of it and end this once and for all. We are standing in the doorway. Muse's support staff of four are all pretending not to be listening. I look at the two agents. Rockdale is giving me flat eyes. Kruger is clenching and unclenching his fists, glaring at me like I just dropped out of a dog's behind. I've had it. So I turn to Muse and say loud enough so that her support staff can hear, 15 years ago, the old Nike control base in Westbridge was an illegal black site incarcerating and interrogating American citizens suspected of colluding with terrorist entities. A bunch of high school kids, including my dead twin brother, taped a Black Hawk helicopter landing there at night. They want the tape from me. I gesture toward the two agents. Their colleagues are, in fact, searching my house right now. It's not there, by the way. Kruger's eyes go wide in shock and anger. He jumps toward me, his hand darting out to throttle me. You need to understand, Leo. I'm good with my fists. I've trained hard, and I'm athletic enough. But I imagine under normal circumstances this guy's more than up to the task of taking me down. So, how to explain what comes next? How to explain that I move fast enough to parry his attack with a forearm? Simple. He is going for the throat. The part of me that lets me breathe. And after last night, after being strapped to the table, something primitive in me will not let that happen. Something both instinctive and maybe supernatural will protect that part of my anatomy no matter what. The problem is, blocking a blow never ends it. You have to deliver one of your own. I use the heel of my palm to strike his solar plexus. It lands flush. Kruger drops to one knee, the wind knocked out of him. I jump back now, fists raised, in case the other guy wants to join in. He doesn't. He stares at his fallen comrade in shock. You just struck a federal officer, Rockdale says to me. In self-defense, Muse shouts. What the hell is wrong with you guys? He gets in her face. Your man just spouted out classified information, which is illegal, especially when it's a lie. How can it be classified? Muse shouts back. If it's a lie! My phone buzzes again, and when I see the message from Ellie, I know I have to get out of here pronto. Found Beth. Look, I say, I'm sorry, okay? Let's just all go inside and straighten this out. I go to help Kruger up. He doesn't like it, pushes my hand away. But there's no more fight in him for now. I keep acting all Mr. Peaceful as we head into Muse's office. I have a plan, a ridiculously simple plan, but sometimes those are the best. Once we settle down, once everyone is seated, I stand and say, I need 2 minutes. Muse says, what's wrong? Nothing. I try to look a little embarrassed. I need the bathroom. I'll be right back. I don't really wait for permission. I'm an adult, right? I head out of Muse's office and down the corridor. No one is following me. Up ahead is the men's room door. I walk past it and hit the staircase. I run down the steps to the ground floor where I slow into a sort of walk-run. Less than 60 seconds after leaving Muse's office, I am outside and putting distance between myself and those federal agents. I call Ellie. Where's Beth? I ask. On her parents' farm in Far Hills. At least I think it's her. Where are you? Newark. I'll text you the address. The ride should take less than an hour. I hang up. I'm moving fast down Market Street. I turn onto University Avenue and use that new app to call Maura. I worry now that she won't answer, that she's vanished back into the ether, but she picks up right away. What's up? Maura asks. Where are you? Double parked in front of the prosecutor's office on Market Street. Head east and make a right on University Avenue. We need to visit an old friend. Chapter 32. Once Maura picks me up, I text Muse. Sorry. I'll explain later. So where are we going? Maura asks. To visit Beth. You found her? Ellie did. I put the address Ellie texted me into my navigation app. It tells us the ride will take 38 minutes.
We start making our way out of the city and onto Route 78 heading west.
Do you have a theory on how Beth Lashley fits into all this? Mora asks.
They were also there that night, I say. By the base. Rex, Hank, Beth. Mora nods.
Makes sense. So we all had a reason to run away.
Except the others didn't. At least not at first. They finished high school. They went to college. Two of them, Rex and Beth, didn't come back. They weren't exactly hiding, but
I think it's clear they wanted no part of Westbridge. Hank, well, he was different. He would walk every day from the old base all the way across town to the railroad tracks, like he was checking the route, like he was trying to figure out how Leo and Diana ended up there. I think I get that now. He last saw them get shot by the base, like you.
I didn't exactly see them get shot, I know, but let's say the conspiracy club were all there except for you. Leo, Diana, Hank, Beth, Rex. Let's say they saw those spotlights and heard that gunfire and all ran. Maybe Hank and the others saw Leo and Diana get shot. Like you, they're scared out of their minds. The next day they find out the bodies were found all the way across town on the railroad tracks. That must have confused the hell out of them.
Mora nods. They probably would have guessed that the guys from the base moved them.
Right.
But they stayed in town.
Mora veers the car onto the highway.
So we have to assume that Reeves and the guys at the base didn't know about Hank, Rex, and Beth. Maybe only Leo and Diana got close enough to the fence.
That makes sense. And my guess is, judging by Reeves' reaction, he didn't know about the tape either.
So they thought I was the only living witness, she says.
Until recently.
Right. So what gave them away now? It's been 15 years.
I think hard about this, and a possible answer comes to me.
Looking out of the corners of her eyes, Mora sees it. What?
The viral video.
What viral video?
Hank supposedly exposing himself. I explained to her about the video of Hank, about how it had gone viral, how most people thought his murder was some kind of act of vigilantism. When I finish, Mora says,
so you think, what, someone from the base saw the video and maybe recognized Hank from that night?
I shake my head. That doesn't make much sense, does it? If they'd seen Hank that night,
they would have identified him earlier. We're still missing something. But I can't help think it has something to do with that viral video. For 15 years, the three of them are safe. Then, that video of Hank on school grounds goes viral. It's related.
A brown sign featuring a red-clad equestrian reads, "Welcome to Far Hills." This isn't farm country, not really. This part of Somerset County is for the wealthy rural set, those who want a huge home on a large plot with nary a neighbor in sight. I know a philanthropist out here who has a 3-hole golf course on his land. I know other guys who own horses or grow apples for cider, or do some other form of what one might label gentleman's farming. I look at Mora's face again, and I feel that sense of being overwhelmed.
I reach out and take her hand.
Mora smiles at me, a smile that hits bone, that makes my blood hum, that jangles my nerves in the best way. She takes my hand, brings it to her lips, kisses the back of it.
Mora.
Yes?
If you need to run again, I'll go too.
She puts my hand on her cheek.
I'm not leaving you, Nap. Just so you know. Stay, go, live, die. I'm not leaving you again.
We don't say anything more. We get it. We aren't hormonal teenagers or star-crossed lovers. We are battle-scarred and wary warriors, and so we know what this means. No pretense. No holding back. No games. Ellie is parked around the corner from Beth's address. We pull up behind her car and step out.
Ellie and Mora embrace. They haven't seen each other in person in 15 years. Since Ellie hid Mora in her bedroom after that night in the woods. When they release the hug, we all move toward Ellie's car. Ellie gets in the driver's seat. I take shotgun. Mora goes into the back. We pull up to the closed gate, blocking the driveway. Ellie hits the buzzer by the intercom. No reply. She hits it again. Still nothing.
In the distance, I see the white farmhouse. Like every other white farmhouse I've ever seen, it's stunning and nostalgic, and you can instantly